Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
In 1944, my grandmother, known to me as Omi, was 1 year old, living with her mother, brother and sister in a village near the German city of Königsberg on the Baltic Sea. In the summer of that year, the family packed their belongings, a sewing machine, coffee grinder, woolen balaclavas and mitts. The furniture was covered, fruits and vegetables preserved in jars and stacked on the shelves because they thought they were coming back. The children were baptized. They boarded a train in the city's central station and headed west. That winter, the Red Army arrived in Königsberg and murdered 300,000 civilians. Many walked across the frozen Baltic to escape the massacre, but they made easy targets for the Russian bombers against the pale ice that shattered beneath their feet. When Germany was divided, the family found themselves in the east, where life was hard. Omi's mother grew tobacco, dried it, and sold her cigarettes in American boxes to buy food. Sending the children ahead, she smuggled herself to the border, posed as a railway worker, shunted carriages and followed the tracks west, wearing a boiler suit and her black leather riding boots. The family reunited in Hamburg and moved into a bombed-out basement with Uncle Walter, who built a home from styrofoam and corrugated metal with a wash basin and plates, towels, cups, a small table. The sewing machine and coffee grinder arrived in 1954. It's 2019 and Omi lives in a terraced house at the edge of a forest in northern Germany. She spends the winter gathering mushrooms, and in the summer she takes her old Volkswagen campervan touring around the Baltic Sea. She sends me photographs of the seaside and flowers in the dunes. This year Omi wants to drive to the town where she was born, now in the Russian enclave of Kaliningrad. It has been 75 years. And she asks if I will come with her. It can be a holiday of sorts, the two of us and the van. We haven't travelled together since I was a child, but this is a journey she doesn't want to take alone. Summer is waning, but the sea is warm. Omi launches herself into the shallows of the Baltic. Dry grasses prick our legs as we gather field mushrooms and apples from a tree tucked in the dunes. Back at the van, Omi cleans the windscreen, sweeps the floor and makes up the camp bed where the two of us have been sleeping head to toe for the past week, as we travel through pine forest and marram grasses, buying smoked fish at the side of the road. It is mid-morning when Omi weaves through concrete barriers at the checkpoint between Lithuania and Russian Kaliningrad, a narrow spit of land in the grey sea. She yanks the handbrake and a soldier escorts us to a hut, checks our papers and searches the van, scans its underside with mirrors. The road is potholed on the other side of the border. Omi is shaken by the crossing, swerves at speed and pulls into a lay-by, handbrake on. The pine forest is a tangle of cobwebs, scattered with a thick stratum of needles. No mushrooms here. We head back to the road. In the afternoon, military helicopters fly low against the sun as the landscape opens to farmland, both of us staring ahead at asphalt as the old van ticks along. That evening, Omi pulls onto a gravel track. We wander amongst the mosses and reindeer lichen, gathering handfuls of blueberries, hunting for gold streaks of chanterelles. The tension of this morning is lost to the cool air of the forest. She has a foraging eye, combs amongst pine needles and ferns and the shrubs with red fruits for the songbirds. Back at the van, Omi fries the mushrooms with onions and cream. She puts a small electric lantern on the folding table and we share a bottle of wine as water laps on the shore past the trees. Next day, the road turns from potholed tarmac to concrete and the van leaps over joints between the slabs. This is a Panzerstrasse, explains Omi, a road built for tanks. It leads us to the village where Omi was born, although the name has changed. Derelict aircraft hangars are reclaimed by the forest, overgrown with mosses and ferns. Quaint German houses decay beside concrete apartment blocks. One of the houses is Omi's old family home, but we can't know which. The van is drawing stares and sideways glances. A woman in a headscarf hangs washing on a line, and children kick a ball around a fenced playing square. We don't even step out of the van. Omi makes a turn, and we head back to the road. We part ways in the city of Kaliningrad. I have to get home, and Omi will follow the coast north and catch a ferry back to Germany. She leaves me at the central station, anxiously checks I have my tickets and passport, berates a conductor and puts me on the train, glances over her shoulder as she walks along the platform and the engine ticks into gear. That evening, as I spoon beetroot soup in the dining car and the clouds grow red, I get a text. Omi has crossed the border and parked her van at the beach. She has found some field mushrooms, fried them with onions and cream, and she has been swimming in the sea.
Now that it's time, now that the hour hand is landed at the end, now that recently, some friends and I went on a short hike. Returning home ravenous some hours later, I invited them in for a quick cup of tea. "I have a fresh batch loaf if you want something to eat," I said. "Ah, no," said friend number one. "I have to get home. A cup of tea would be lovely, though." "I'm in a rush as well," said friend number two. "And besides, I never eat white bread." "Grand so," I said. "A cup of tea it is." The two of them sat down at the kitchen table while I put the kettle on. "I haven't seen bread like that in years," said friend number one, eyeing the batch loaf in its red and yellow packaging on the kitchen worktop. "It's for my brother who lives in England," I said. "It's what he always asks for when he comes home. That and lots of butter." "Sure, I might as well have a slice, seeing as how it's here," she said. I went and got some plates, knives and the butter dish. Friend number one took the batch loaf and began to peel open the greaseproof paper wrapping. She opened back the fold, prized up the heel, and eased out a slice. She laid the slice on her plate, picked up her knife, and took the lid off the butter dish. "Oh, yum," she said. "Real butter. Nothing like it." The scent of freshly baked batch loaf wafted around the table. "Have you any jam?" she asked as she dug her knife into the butter and began to spread a large yellow dollop onto her slice. Friend number two watched all this with interest. Her eyes were transfixed on the knife as it spread the butter right up to the edges of the crust in neat circular swirls. "I don't eat butter either," she announced, apropos of nothing. But her voice didn't hold the same assertion it had when she told us she never ate white bread. It may even have held a hint of regret. It really was only a matter of time. The butter spreading complete, friend number one cut the slice in two, unscrewed the lid from the blackberry jam and scooped out a large spoonful. This she spread on the curvy side of her batch slice, leaving the straight side jam free. She then cut each half slice in two, picked up one of them and bit into it. "Mmm," she said, her teeth leaving a deep semicircular curve in the butter. Friend number two shifted in her seat and sipped her tea. I, by now, was already buttering my own slice of batch loaf. As I bit into it, friend number one was reaching for a second helping. That was when friend number two cleared her throat. "Have you any marmalade?" she asked. "It's marmalade we had on it when I was a child." She picked up her knife, reached for a slice, and with a sigh of deep resignation, began to spread it with butter. A patch loaf may have a very distinctive scent, but as with Proust's Madeleine moment, it's the taste that brings the memories flooding back. The bread man arriving to our street in his horse-drawn van, the whinny of the horse, the clatter of the reins, the clip-clapping of the hooves, the mothers rushing out in their aprons, the wooden trays sliding out to display mouth-watering chocolate eclairs, cream donuts, Viennese whirls, and joy, the batch loaves, lined up like miniature pillows, their crust black-brown, their inside soft as thistledown. The bread man would pull the batch apart and place one loaf in my mother's outstretched hands. She'd carry it like a trophy back into the kitchen, to be sliced there and then without delay, each of us children smothering it with thick yellow butter and rushing back out onto the street to show off our bounty. The bread man's van would barely have reached the end of the street when all our batch loaf was gone. "Did bread and butter always taste this good?" my two friends wondered as we wiped the crumbs away. I assured them it did. Nothing now remained of the batch loaf, only the two heels, which nobody in our house ever wanted anyway, and usually found their way into the toaster when the day-old freshness had waned. Ah, well, sure, there was nothing for it, only to go out and buy another loaf. We couldn't let my brother down now, could we?
You sheltered me from harm, kept me warm, kept me warm. You gave my life to me, set me free. Set me free.
The 1985 Heysel Stadium disaster is a far-off, almost forgotten tragedy. But for those directly affected, it casts long shadows. Brussels in the 1980s was a bourgeois, cosmopolitan city, mesmerizing in its linguistic complexities, but relaxed, at ease with itself. The Irish community was small. We had a Gaelic club, which played occasional matches, and a soccer team in the Brussels Embassy League. Through this rather loose connection, 10 of us got tickets for that year's European Cup final at Heysel Stadium on the 29th of May. Unexpected, but very exciting. Liverpool were facing Juventus and our tickets were for the neutral terrace. The day itself was hot, steamy and sticky. Ahead of the game, fans gathered and drank strong Belgian beer in the many bars around the Grand Place. We went directly from work by metro from Schumann, the European Commission headquarters. Our suits left at the office, T-shirts and jeans more in keeping with our anticipation of a great game between Europe's leading clubs. Getting into the ground presented few difficulties. Local policemen surveyed the good-humoured crowd. Around us on the neutral terrace were many Belgian-born Italians, most of them sons of migrant workers who had come to work in the mines after the war. The first hints of trouble were fairly mild. Some Liverpool fans started chanting from their terrace, divided from us neutrals by only some flimsy barriers and a handful of policemen. But chanting is normal enough. Attention now turned to the match just 20 minutes from kick-off. Then some Liverpool fans started tossing things at us. Oranges, apples, tomatoes. The people around us became restless, like a herd sensing predators. What happened next was much more sinister. Harder missiles were coming our way. Some Liverpool supporters, thugs, not supporters in truth, were now hurling bottles at us and stones. They were swarming the little barriers. Now they were over them, brushing the hapless policemen aside and charging us, brandishing poles which moments earlier had carried proud Liverpool colours. We were in the midst of a panicking crowd, and quickly in the crush I was separated from my companions. Some of the crowd were running back up the terrace towards the exits, some pushing down towards the pitch. I decided going down wasn't good, and going up wasn't great either, so I tried to hold my ground. Those running back were wisest, I later discovered, for they escaped the imminent mayhem, but for the odd slap of a stick or loss of a shoe. Those pushing or being pushed downwards, squeezed into others further down who fell and were crushed against the crumbling wall protecting the pitch. Such was the pressure, there was little chance to climb the wall and reach the pitch. Even if your arms were free, the rest of you was trapped in the crowd. I tried to hold on, but the crowd eventually forced me down. I fell, and those beside me did likewise, until we were a human heap, like a landslide, slowly rolling down the terrace. I managed to wriggle to a crowd barrier, which afforded some slight protection, and lay there trying to free my shoulders and breathe while being pinned down by falling and fallen bodies. I remember thinking, this is absurd. I've played hurling all my life. I've been in every big stadium watching GAA and rugby. And now I'm going to die at a football match because of hooliganism. But in 6 or 7 minutes, perhaps, I began to feel the pressure on my back ease, and I could sense the crowd beginning to stand up behind me. The thugs seemed to be in retreat. I unsteadily began to stand up, but the two men who had been pressing down on my arms did not. They were motionless, either worn out by their efforts to stay alive or possibly already dead. Shaking, I looked around for help. I could see police reinforcements coming across the terrace. At the terrace walls, there were piles of people still unable to move, trapped just inches from the pitch and safety. Further up the terrace, bodies lay strewn where they fell. A Red Cross volunteer appeared beside me. Her colleagues would look after the injured, he told me. She helped me to the pitch and I walked unsteadily to the far end, trousers and shirt ripped, face, arms and hands scratched and bloodied to rest a while in safety. The pitch was slowly cleared of human casualties and incredibly, the match went ahead. This was afterwards explained as being to reduce the risk of more crowd trouble. I stood in a daze for a while, then managed to get out, onto a metro and back to Schumann to join my girlfriend and other friends and seek out news of those who had not yet returned from Heysel. It was a long night of waiting and wondering until 2 or 3 in the morning when we were able to confirm that all our friends were safe. I was also trying to phone home, fully aware that the tragedy had been shown live on television, unfolding as the TV audience waited for the match to begin. When I finally got through to my parents, it was 11:30, as the lines had been blocked for hours. I could hear the relief and uncharacteristic emotion in my father's voice when he said, "We're so delighted you're all right." Next day, we woke up to a shocking toll of death and destruction. Among the 39 dead, all from the neutral terrace, were 32 Italians, 4 French, 2 Belgians, and a man from Belfast. About 600 people had been injured and treated by the emergency services or in hospitals across Belgium. There was much debate as to responsibility. Certainly the stadium was run down and unsuitable by the standards of the time. The placing of Liverpool fans was thoughtless, not least given the growing reputation of a small cohort of English fans for causing trouble and their lack of distinction between neutrals and opposing fans. Security was far from perfect, and policing within the stadium was almost totally lacking. In fact, it seems preparations by all concerned were hopelessly inadequate, with the important exception of the medical services. But not one of these inadequacies justifies the appalling behaviour of the perpetrators who had love of violence as their motive, and certainly not love of football. The wheels of justice turned slowly. Almost 5 years later, some thugs were convicted of manslaughter and received very short sentences for the part they played in the disaster. As far as I was concerned, the message that violent hooliganism is not subject to proportionate justice could not have been clearer. I've never forgotten that day. I still think about those young men on the terrace around me who never came home. Husbands, brothers, sons. Children unborn, dreams unfulfilled, all because of a tragedy that should never have happened.
Recently, I stopped into TK Maxx to buy clothes hangers and walked out with a chocolate rabbit. The woman at the register dropped it into my bag as a thank you for considering signing up for their rewards program. Since I'd been thinking about chucking personal productivity to one side and spending the rest of my day rewatching the movie Chocolat, I viewed the chocolate rabbit as something akin to divine blessing of this plan and returned home to settle in. It wasn't just that I wanted to hear Johnny Depp with his Irish accent, and the movie's assertion that chocolate can cure most ills just strikes me as obvious. It was more that, each time the north wind comes around, the film's main character uproots herself and moves someplace new. This is a compulsion I know something about. As a kid, I'd imagined a simple future whose trajectory would be defined by my dream of becoming a writer. I'd go to university, write books, marry, and live quietly in New England with three children and a basset hound I'd call Clyde. Life unfolded differently, however. Following graduation, I navigated difficult relationships, moving from state to state until I found myself lost and driving north one autumn through the desolate Texas plains, landing, ultimately, in a gold mining town tucked into the Colorado Rocky Mountains. I arrived with everything I owned stuffed into the back of my truck and no sense at all where my life was headed. The town resembled a Western movie set. At 8,300 feet in elevation, it had 200 residents, dirt roads lined with wooden cabins, a general store, and a two-room schoolhouse. It had dense pockets of aspen trees, 4-foot winter snowfalls, and coyotes who howled at night as if there were something in the heavens they needed and were trying to lasso with their sound. And it had John. John was 40 years older than me. He had white hair and a fondness for Stilton cheese. Originally from Manchester, he was a climate physicist who specialized in the study of lightning. He was also a poet. Hearing that I enjoyed writing, he suggested we meet to discuss our work. The problem was that I had none to share. For years, I'd spent equal amounts of energy both wanting to write and avoiding doing it. I'd been preoccupied with survival, afraid that to dabble in writing would only illuminate the painful distance of that dream. But I was too polite to refuse John's offer, so I said yes and spent the next several days fumbling with a poem. When the day came, I climbed the stone steps to John's cabin feeling like a fraud. We sat clutching mugs of tea in his bay window. I knew my poem was clumsy, but John never said so. Instead, he sought reasons for praise and gently suggested edits. He shared one of his own poems, telling me afterward, laughing, how an ex-girlfriend had criticized his reading voice. "I hate your yearning voice," she'd said when they'd broken up. But I listened closely to John, noticing how even the room itself seemed to lean in when he read. In the months afterward, we continued our workshops, and I kept on writing. Sometimes, to pass an evening, a group of townspeople would gather in John's cabin to share poems, stories, or music. Adopting a fake-it-till-you-make-it approach, I shared my work as well, my voice quavering. We'd sit in shadows cast by the wood stove's tangerine flames and tumble out later for the walk home, sweeping our torches around to look for bears. Here, I used to think, was a place I could remain forever. Here was simplicity and a warm, rare alignment with what it meant to be human in the natural world. But I sensed change on the gusting winds. I started attending summer workshops, and a few years ago, I moved to Dublin to study creative writing at Trinity College, which is how I came to be watching Chocolat the other day while peeling the foil off a chocolate rabbit. It had been years since I'd been in a university setting, but I'd loved the Trinity program and had made it through. I'd believed I would because of John, who developed dementia and passed away shortly before my move. And really, this isn't a story about writing, but rather about John and people like him. The ones who blow into your life and help you remember who and where you meant to be. How the immortal weather of their kindness persists. The way a mountain lion once crossed my path in a Colorado canyon, and I watched its noble head slip into darkness, while its tail in my headlights kept going on.
He was born in the summer of his 27th year, coming home to a place he'd never been before. He left yesterday behind him, you might say he was born again.
A dance in the gap of time. And soul, rise up and dance, the words you wrote a decade ago. Vietnam still vivid in mind and feet, a Mekong of water under all the bridges since, the mighty river of our lives sweeping all before it and rising, rising, the elver soup you ate in Saigon, the splendour of Ho Chi Minh City, though you didn't go to see the shrine. How to keep your feet steady, or kick fast and stay afloat, swim, dance to shore, away from shore, under the Pont du Diable, the sandstone arches hot in the summer glare. All that fall, that rise, that splash and gulp and kick, a black calf in a springing meadow. You're 13 again and hanging back, longing to take the floor, not sure how to put a foot forward best or not. And kind, blunt Keelty spots your need and grabs your hand, grabs too the hand of little Bridget McGovern from Glan and pushes you together out onto the prefab floor and you're away 10cc rubber bullets. I went to a party at the local county jail. Not too far away, real bullets flying. Years later, 81, you almost land in the local jail as you dance around a Gartha car outside Creevely Hall, asking them what they're doing, watching the crowds coming to a dance in support of the hunger strikers in the north. You're pinned against the car, all your drunken fervour up against the strong arm of the law, and you lose, but are not locked up because the guard knows your sister. And in you go to waltz triumphant, maybe jive, you don't remember, talk for Ireland for sure. Sean South from Gary Owen were on the one road, the men behind the wire. And they should have been dancing, the young men, not martyred, emaciated, sainted, dead. They should have been free and wild on disco floors, in parish halls, in Mayflowers and ballrooms of romance and lust and falling in and out of love. Shots volley out, clods fall. I saw a ghost in Creevely Hall, a loom at the window, impossibly tall. My brothers hear footsteps echo walk across the empty floor one winter day. Summers we'd walk through the ruins of the house in the hills where my parents started out in 44. Music and dance in that small stone kitchen on the September night they married. Mick Woods, 14, and a head of blackberry hair on him. The lintel over the door still in place, the back wall a gap of broken stone. We step out into the haggard and how the midges flicker and smudge. Near Pulna still, you catch a greenish frog and watch its quiet pulse. Then acrobat stretch and bounce away to water. Kyo Lee. The dancing mind brings back old words and phrases, blue mould cleared and language bubbles up, all there, tap, tap. And a field away, another house, gone, gone, horse skull under a flagstone, another flag scooped out round for milk. The black cat lands, a shadow in from shadows, licks and licks, purr sets music stirring. and a tune breaks out, up and away. He seizes the woman round the kitchen, over the cradle, out the door. The fields fly, ditches, briars. A baby tumbles into a gripe, and winged she rises up, clears white thorn, electric wires, tall as Scots pine. Swallow, marten, wren, air, crane, swift air, till cry, squall, legs flailing, iron around her, holy water, cat by the hob, green-eyed, tail flicking, swish, swish. Later, or was it earlier, another dance, the moon behind the hill, soars out, goodbye forever, go, gone, footstick across water, never home. Mary Ann, Mary Ann, the bus conductor waltzes a small girl's doll up and down the aisle, singing, swinging, the golden-haired treasure. The girl laughs, cries, remembers it forever. Whitehall, Burr, Brussels, London, Languedoc. How the dance carries us, the steps in Connemara, a teacher to the other students, dance like him, like what? All you know is the swing the music takes you on, the breath, the glow, sea light, new, a friend taken by a colour photo of you dancing with your mother, cousin's wedding, silver silk shirt and pink. What was it he saw? They were Lightfoot and Sure, the young pair, old pair, starlit, moonlit, lake-lit, wind-lit, rose light, climbing, climbing, dancing, dancing, dancing. Decades, decades, time never stop.
On this morning's Sunday Miscellany, we heard Mushroom Picking by Alexander McMaster, The Batch Loaf by Maeve Edwards. The Heysel Stadium Disaster was by Michael Hamill, A Change in the Weather by Elizabeth Oxley, and A Dance in the Gap of Time, a poem by Vincent Woods. And the music today was The Fairest of the Seasons by The Velvet Underground and Nico, Everything I Own by Bread, Sicilienne by Maria Teresa von Paradis, featuring Jacqueline Dupré on cello, and Rocky Mountain High by John Denver. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy. And you can listen back on the RTE Radio app or on all the usual podcast platforms. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.